The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Welcome to Spawnometer 0032. We're going to be talking about a story by Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo. There are special thanks to Kevin Conrad again, plus Julia Simmons, but I don't really see it on the page. The book looks like it's by the two main creators. The story is called Appearances, and besides the lead story, there's also a six-page backup called Blood Feud, Preludes and Nocturnes by Alan Moore and Tony Daniel. We're not going to cover that at this time, but just acknowledging it. The story is dedicated to my wife, Wanda Kolomijek, and I don't know why I particularly decided to shout her out at this point, but good for him. The cover is a silhouette of the new look Spawn at, I'm assuming, dusk. It could be dawn, but it's, I don't know if it's a coloring technique or if they use a little bit of a photo manipulation, but you've got a sun and clouds. What do you think of the cover? I like it. I think it's one of the more distinctive Spawn covers.
Nah, it's kind of downhill from the Lynching one.
No argument there, but I do think it's a good body posture, and I do think that orange hue against the silhouette really makes it pop and is more distinctive than a lot of the other Spawn covers to come. This, I think it's, generally speaking, a good run of covers we're looking at right now. So the issue was released on June 15th, 1995. This was the same month that we got Exo Manowar number 50X and number 50O, drawn by Bart Sears and Andy Smith, so we know what he was doing instead of doing Violeta miniseries, for instance. This was the debut of the Ruins two-part miniseries, the super dark anti-Marvels. Batman Forever was released with all the accompanying comic books you expect and other merchandise. Judge Dredd was also released the same summer. We've got New Shadowhawk number one. We've got Spawn Blood Feud number one, which is, you know, why we've got the prelude story in this issue, but it's nice to see they coordinated it to where we've got them both in the same month. You've got Violator versus Batroc number one this month. You've got Operation Nightstrike number one this month. Again, one of the reasons why that was never finished was probably because of the falling out between Rob Liefeld and Image. So that countdown clock is still kicking in the background.
I guess something happened because Spawn knows where the angels are now at. He's climbing a building, big skyscraper.
And I like that splash page where you get the semi-panoramic view of New York, including the Twin Towers. Definitely nobody used a ruler for this, but it still looks kind of cool because it's almost like the city is swirling around the central point.
Oh yeah, no, that is a great splash page. But we see Spawn climbing a building. What's her name?
The Raphael?
Is it Raphael? I keep wanting to call her Blanche.
It doesn't help that it's a lady named Raphael.
Yes.
And they're really leaning into the age here too. I mean, they put as many wrinkles as possible, elongated claw fingers and stuff like that. Have her putting on lipstick.
She seems to be a chain smoker as well. So Raphael is expecting a visit. She's getting ready. She's kind of, you know, prepping herself up. And then these
gives herself a spritz of Banaka.
Yeah, a very, very elderly woman comes walking in and tells her how good it is to see her. They all seem to be in awe of this other woman, who's the oldest of them all, more of a Sophia.
Plus 30, looks like.
Yeah, 30 trillion. Talking about how, you know, it's sad the last one didn't work with her predecessor, how, you know, there's things that are going on in the background, and all of a sudden Spawn just like smashes in a great splash page. We get a glimpse of the new Spawn suit with the giant gauntlets, chains are whipping.
Let's take a minute and break down the suit. So the changes that we've made is that he has those more like a gauntlet, like it's almost like a Wonder Woman bracelet, but like super duper spiky. Everything has spikes all over it, and where McFarlane had more like the studded spikes, like sort of like you'd see on a punk rock jacket from the 80s. Capullo's gone for like much longer, curved, more jagged, organic looking spikes all over the place. And so he's got essentially like a bit of a cestus on one hand and then a gauntlet on the other hand. All the red has been taken out of the torso portion of the costume. The skulls that were before more like Punisher skulls now have these long fangs on them and look more vampiric. The chains are bigger and thicker. The pinstriping has been taken out. It used to have white stripes that ran down his arms and down parts of the legs. those are gone. And where he used to just have sort of black leggings for on his feet, he's now got the one gigantic covering thing, extremely similar to the same kind of boot that Angela has, to the point where I have to wonder if Elysium had some sort of influence over his costume. And then he's got another like sort of jagged thingy on his other foot. Plus, they switched the sides. He used to have that weird thigh pocket thingy on his right leg. Now it's on the left leg. A lot of changes to the costume while still clearly keeping the core qualities of Spawn. He's still unmistakably Spawn, but definitely gives him more of like violent edge to him.
True. A little more punk rock, I guess you could say.
He seems like blacker too. Like the suit itself seems to be a darker shade of black, where I think they used to do more blues in there for hues. Now we're going with grays and more solid blacks.
Yeah, I could go with that. So he's attacking them. Sophia's running away. Spawn looks at Raphael. They have some words. Raphael calls in, I guess, their security squad.
And once again, we're back to like the all ladies too. Everybody
in this building seems to be a woman. They go to, you know, you see the dots forming on Spawn's head.
Yeah, it's funny that angels have laser targeted, you know, assault rifles.
It's kind of weird. Yeah. Well, because you would figure they'd have like bow staffs like Angela did.
Mm-hmm.
Where she, didn't she throw like lightning bolts out of her staff and shit? I don't remember. That
energy blast. I don't know about lightning, but yeah.
Yeah. So Spawn grabs Sophia, has her by the throat. He's threatening to kill her.
I love this that he's got so many spikes on his costume that he's tearing his own great cape open again.
I do like the look now. Mm-hmm. It's cool. They all back off once he starts. But what is it that they're all freaking out over?
Let's do the flashback first. So they've got Spawn cornered with the laser sights all over his head. He's threatening to kill the woman who identifies herself as Mary because she decided to take the name of the mother of Raphael, who she hadn't thought about for a long time but appreciated being able to call this woman Mary. And then we flash back to the alleys after Bobby was kidnapped by Redeemer.
Well, no. So he has Sophia by the throat, threatening all the angels back off. Raphael's pissed. We all of a sudden we go to a scene with Wanda and Terry, where Terry has decided to...
Wait, are you skipping something?
No, you're skipping the part with Cagliostro, aren't you? No, there's one. He jumps through the window. He grabs Sophia. They all got their guns trained on him. They're all kind of reacting to like, do you see who he got? And they're like, yeah. And Raphael does a speech. And then all of a sudden, my next page is Wanda and Terry talking about his transfer papers.
So you don't have the page where with Cagliostro. So, okay. So let me jump in here then. So we flash backward. Cagliostro shows up and he gives Spawn a card telling him that this is where he can find Bobby. And when Spawn first looks at the card, it doesn't say anything, but then he looks again and it gives the address of 9 East 48th Street, which is funny because I decided, well, that sounds like a real place. Let me Google it. Sure enough, it does exist. It's like an office building. It doesn't look like it's as big as the one pictured in the books because it doesn't look like it so towers over everything around it, but it is quite tall. Directly across the street is a Dos Toros Taqueria, and inside the building is Church of Sweden. So I guess we can now know that the version of heaven represented in this series is affiliated with the Church of Sweden. It's also a 3-minute walk from Rockefeller Center.
Holy crap, dude. That's missing out of my reprint. Oh. I'm reading it on a reprint.
So
the actual book. Wanda and Terry are discussing how Terry's about to transfer, I'm assuming, out of the government.
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. I think he's transferring specifically into Wynn's section so that he can have access to Wynn.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay, then I misread that. I read it as he was leaving.
Yeah, no, I think it feels more and more like the hero of the series is Terry. He may not be the person with the powers, but this is a guy who just, his entire life was ruined. He looked like he was going to go to prison or die. He didn't know what was going to happen to his family. He was brutally beaten multiple times at this point. He's gone through so much shit, and most any one of us would just be like, fuck it, I'm done. I'm just going to coast in my job going forward and not start any more trouble. And this guy's like, no, I'm not going to stop until I can deal with this. He's seen the consequences of going after this guy, and he still steps up and is continuing to pursue him. You may not be the smartest course, but it's definitely the most courageous and the most heroic. And Wanda, despite specifically marrying Terry to not be with a guy like Al, to be with a guy who's going to work from an office and not have to pull his gun and not have to risk his life all the time, she still holds his hand. She still gives him the green light because she knows that that's what he needs to do, and she knows that that's the right thing to do. And she's a person who's very right-minded. She works for charities. She works for the benefit of mankind. So it's nice because not only is Terry continuing to step up, even after everything he's gone through, but Wanda is as well. And this time, Wanda actually gives him her backing. He isn't running around behind her back and keeping her out of the loop and shit. He knows that if shit goes south, it's going to impact on her too. So he's finally doing the right thing by her as well and making sure that they're both on the same page as far as where his next move is. And she gives her consent for him to continue with this. So definitely a pivotal scene in my mind, and definitely shows the character of Terry Fitzgerald.
Okay. The next thing we see, the chief, he's freaking out. He's calling Jason because Sam and more than Twitch is busting his balls about what they have have on him. Of course, the folders, the mighty power of the folders. Next, we see, I hope this is in your book because it's in mine, where Spawn has Sophia by the throat and he's counting down because he's going to kill her if they don't give him back Billy. He's doing the thread. He does the countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2. And then he tells him, all right, you win.
Or Raphael tells him, all right, you win.
She calls up the station. They have Billy attached to this anal probe machine where they seem to be checking him in every orifice. Because again, and we kind of missed this part, when the Redeemer teleported Billy, the whole point was because Billy had residue of the necroplasm or whatever, the sponges, and it had never been documented. Mm-hmm. So that's why he took him.
Spawn to actually give some of his power to another person, it never happened before.
And rejuvenate him. Yeah, because he has like traces of it.
Well, and so one thing I think is really interesting is we've got two issues in a row where we've got male nudity, and it's pretty explicit, pretty near explicit. I mean, there's only like a little dangle thing that's preventing us from seeing the manhood of Bobby. And there's, in both instances, there's a quality of body horror to them. The whole process for Bobby, there's been this weird body horror, this transgressive quality, this like almost like pseudo molestation that's going on with Redeemer. And I like that quality of horror being in the book. And I also like that they're actually having men in circumstance of sexual torment, because we see that done to women so often that to have the roles reversed, it's effective. It definitely like, whoa, shit, I hadn't seen that before. And it's equal time as well. If we're going to do horrible shit to women, you got to be willing to do horrible shit to men. And this book is going there. So respect for that.
Cool. Much respect.
Now, did you notice though that when Spawn was threatening Mary, the energy bubble around her head that he was threatening her with was really big at first, and it gets progressively smaller. And he eventually has to cop to the fact that he'd actually was losing his power. And by the time he was getting to the end of his countdown, he'd already kind of queefed out and there was just nothing left for him.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out why in a moment.
Are we?
Yes. So
they do, you know, Redeemer does bring Bobby back to the building where the angels are housed. And there's this shot where he's crying and he's drenched in sweat and he's nude and he's only covered by part of Redeemer's cape. And there's this really great foreshortening where his hand's coming right at you. Very difficult to pull off, and Capullo just fucking nails it. But again, that body horror and that sense of violation in Bobby, it's something we rarely see with men in comics, and they really fucking sell it here.
Well, so Billy arrives. Raphael tells him to finish him off.
Redeemer, that is.
The Redeemer, yeah. Redeemer shows up, starts jumping around, blasting, and this time Spawn is a little more on his A-game. The chains and the cape immediately go into combat mode. He tells Billy to get out of the way. The suit is jumping around. Him and the Redeemer are battling. I did think it was pretty cool that he chopped off the Redeemer's hand.
Well, yeah, and he up to damn near the elbow, and he does it with his cape.
Yeah, so now the cape seems to be having some new types of powers as well. Almost, instead of being like a grappling, because the chains were always like smash, grab, mm-hmm. and the cape was kind of like grab, hold. Now the cape is cut, grab, hold, teleport, spaghetti-o, whatever. Mm-hmm. But of course, he starts losing his power again.
Yeah, and after the arm is cut off too, you have all this eldritch energy shooting, elemental fire, they call it, shooting out of the stump, uncontrollably.
And he's like blasting everywhere, even his own handlers. He can't control this blast.
Yeah, the building's coming apart all around them.
And Spawn actually apologizes to Sophia as he's running by her, telling her, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. She's like, you're okay. He gets hit by a blast. Him and Billy go through a wall. And when they're on the other side of the wall, that's when the elite angels pop up. They aim their guns. They're looking at Spawn. Spawn is trying to protect Billy as best he can. And all of a sudden, they teleport. They wake up in the alleyway. Billy's there. Spawn's knocked out. Cog is sitting there telling him, don't worry. You know, he's just passed out. He's not dead. He goes, but not bad for Spawn, especially since he went up against God. Yeah. And of course, Billy's like, God. And we find out that Sophia's actually God.
It was nice too, because instead of having that weird meat splooge thing when he teleported, now it's an energy, a green energy. And so it's not as icky, you know? Yeah. And we also see that the power usage brought him down to 6902.
You know, the angels are freaking out because apparently no evil is supposed to be able to enter that building. But apparently Spawn, there's something special about him where he was able to penetrate the defenses. Because apparently there's like a barrier, because no one has ever. And of course, I kind of missed the part where Raphael was talking about how Spawn had violated the pact between heaven and hell for the war. And Sophia's like, no, you kids aren't ready to fight yet. When you're ready, it'll be time. There's something special about him. And then she just kind of floats away out of the building.
I like, too, that once Spawn appears, all the other angels are freaking out and being hyper-aggressive. And pretty much the whole time she's grinning because she sees something special in Spawn that she hadn't seen in any other Spawns or any other, you know, she knows something's up immediately because
God.
She would. Yeah.
What if God was one of us?
Just as slob.
Isn't there a song
like
that says God is a woman?
Yeah, there was. There was. I don't remember who. Was it Beyonce?
I figured you would know this shit.
I know the existence of the song, but that wasn't on any of my albums. I do have that Joan Osborne album, though.
Okay.
So what'd you think of this?
What did you think, Frank?
I liked it. I thought it good action, progressing the story along, some really great artwork, interesting flourishes, definitely a take on heaven that we hadn't seen before with all these, you know, old ladies running around. I'm continuing to enjoy the series.
I agree. This issue was definitely my favorite so far, except for the writer's block. I enjoyed this one quite a bit. I thought it was
your favorite of the Todd written ones is what I'm getting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Todd definitely stepping up his game now.
We'll institute now as a rule that anytime we give a compliment like that, unless we specifically mention the writer's block is still the best. Until
is definitely the
that's the mark to meet
set with the writer's block.
Mm-hmm. So we have to specifically point out that it's their actual challenger. Otherwise, we're just talking about Todd issues.
Okay.
After Spawn number 8, Todd McFarlane Productions received bags of letters asking for more stories, Alan Moore, and so that's how you ended up with the Blood Feud miniseries. Also, McFarlane in the letters columns mentioned how there's a lot of information that he didn't feel like he could convey in the monthly book, and because he didn't want to bog things down or make things run any slower than they already were, he enjoyed like doing these little side projects that could explain certain circumstances. So that's kind of the genesis for Blood Feud, is the fact that Spawn had a lot of similarities in terms of what he does to supernatural creatures, and they wanted to explore that outside of the ongoing series. The story is called Blood Feud, Preludes and Nocturnes. It starts with the curse waking up to the clanging of church bells, blaming his creator and cursing him. Quote, he does not fear God's wrath, because having been abandoned by the Lord, bested by Spawn, and left nailed to an alley wall, he figured God had taken his best shot. When Curse calls out to his almighty torturer, the crazy-eyed, long-haired blonde dude who approached him thought he was being overly praised. He also thought the curse was an unfortunate name that suggested that things had gone badly for him while he was in school. My name, on the other hand, is John, much more sensible. John was a self-proclaimed monster hunter, and the curse, well, you see where this is heading. John had questions about Spawn he wanted answered, started with how many times Curse had seen him drink the blood of small children. Despite being sworn to destroy the Hell Spawn, even he wouldn't descend to such vile practices. So John dismembered the curse until he was given the right answer. Dozens of times, maybe hundreds, John demanded more practical information about Spawn's habits and associates, and even though he had every intention to keep torturing Curse, he hoped that he wouldn't squirm too much while tied to the bell tower ropes. People might be trying to sleep. The great iron throats sing out, tolling for Spawn. You not remember that part?
No, I don't. Was that in the regular Spawn series?
Yeah, I had to drive all over Houston trying to find a copy of that issue of Spawn with that fucking 6-page backup, since this story has never been collected in trade paperback. McFarlane only collected his Spawn run, not the Satellite miniseries. So there's, as far as I can tell, there's no other way to read that little short prelude to Nocturne riffing off of Sandman.
Yeah, I did not know that. Because when you were talking about that, I'm like, I don't remember reading any of this in fucking Blood Feuds. I'm like, did I read the right fucking Blood Feuds?
Yeah, and what's weird too is the curse never appears again in this miniseries, so it's really left field.
That's crazy.
So in Overstreet's Fan Magazine number 1, cover dated June 1995, there's an interview with artist Tony Daniel conducted by Ben Ray, as well as an uncredited interviewer for The Mighty Eye number 1, dated May-June of 95. Tony Daniel talked about how he'd been drawing full comic books of his own characters for himself since 4th grade. He got his butt whipped for posing like the Hulk in a school picture. Inspired since age 9 by the likes of Frank Frazetta, Jack Kirby, Jim Lee, and Frank Miller, he referenced as early favorites Romita Spider-Man, Kirby Thor, and Fantastic Four, and they said colon Avengers, but I don't remember Gene Colan ever doing the Avengers, and also they misspelled his name like brutally, so I'm thinking maybe they meant Buscema, or I don't know. Anyway, so later influences on Tony Daniel were the Image guys, especially Todd McFarlane, Dale Keown, and Wills Portacio. Tony Daniel hated the way his work looked in print. He just never felt like he was good enough. And but he did like seeing what the colors would do at his work once it was printed. He wasn't very happy with Marvel's colors, but he made a point of giving a shout out to Todd Broker for his work on Blood Feud. Tony Daniels' first submission and rejection was to Marvel at age 13. He tore up the letter, he cried, and considered quitting, but he kept practicing. Although he never had much luck in terms of formal art education, he was mostly self-taught. His first big break was on X-Force, even though he drew about 9 issues of Elementals that had yet to see print by that point. He said that the other thing with Kimiko and the Elementals was just drawing comics and someone giving me a check. No one else saw it or anything. I know they are going to release all my old stuff, which looks like my old stuff. And I think maybe like 5 of those 9 issues eventually came out over a span of several years. So Tony DeAngelo replaced Greg Capullo on X-Force from issues 28 through 43, drawing about 12 of those 15 issues. He also did the first 2 issues of Gambit and the Externals from the Age of Apocalypse before he fulfilled his commitment to Marvel and bailed, leaving the rest of the miniseries to Sal LaRocca. He left Marvel not because of money or working conditions, but because he just couldn't feel like he was himself. He wasn't happy with his own work. He thought Marvel felt the same way. He especially wanted off the X-Books, and he wanted to do a solo title like Hulk or Spider-Man, 2 of his childhood favorites. He was just tired of the corporate machine and how nobody was listening to his ideas. He gave a lot of credit to inker Kevin Conrad on X-Force, who Marvel kept trying to replace, so neither of them felt like they had job security. Kevin Conrad was a buddy of Greg Capullo's back to high school. They both had long hair and they played in a metal band together. Capullo and Conrad wanted to be in comics in 1983, but it took a while for them to actually get that worked out. He'd been a commercial artist for 10 years before his buddy Capullo put in the good word for him with Bob Harris, got him a job on X-Force starting with issue number 22. Conrad's listed influences include Joe Sinnott, Klaus Janson, Art T-Bear, and Scott Williams. Tony DeAngelo was tapped as the artist. He was 24 at the time that he started working on the book. He was scared of working with Alan Moore, but he found Moore to be such a nice and helpful person on the phone that he was put totally at ease. He'd never read any of Moore's comic books. He only knew him from the Mystique, the legend that he was. Going off of Moore's thumbnails improved his own layouts tenfold, according to the artist, and he felt like he was a better artist overall for having seen or been guided by Moore's scripts. He said of Blood Feud that it was a miniseries packed with mystery and symbolism, and that his ultimate dream project was to work with Frank Miller, hopefully on a Spawn book, but definitely not at DC or Marvel. Tony Daniel wanted to make sure to remain unpredictable and to constantly evolve, but he was having so much fun with Spawn and learning from Todd, and did eventually expect to go off into his own project someday, but he just wasn't ready for that yet. He had a great sense of camaraderie at TMP. He had lots of help getting mentored by Todd McFarlane. He mentioned how he stopped drawing blood at Marvel because they just color it yellow like puke, and he quoted saying, "Todd lets me run loose, there's no restrictions." Also in that same interview, Kevin Conrad took a dig at Peter David, noting that those who can't draw right. So reading the 2 interviews, and some of it was set up by the interviewer, and I gotta say too, the Mighty Eye 2-page interview was almost unreadable. Just the layouts were terrible, the spelling was bad, grammar. It's hard to listen to a bunch of artists talk shit about writing who can't even lay out text on a page. And it also pissed me off because at one point Tony Daniel was talking about all the great ideas he had, and yet he would never come up with any specific items except for shit like, "They colored my blood the puke colored," and stuff like that. So it's like, are they great ideas, or is it just a bunch of onanistic bullshit and you don't want to draw the actual story stuff? When Tony Daniel does his own work, I'll see how great his ideas really were, you know? But it doesn't help these guys to talk shit about writers, especially when they've got Alan Moore writing the miniseries for them. It's like, well, you guys aren't writing this shit. Alan Moore's writing it. Where the fuck were you at? That leads us into Blood Feud number 1. It was released on June 22nd, 1995. It came out 1 week after Spawn number 32, as promised in that issue. It was a 4-issue miniseries on a perfect monthly schedule, and the Angela Special Edition number 1 shipped earlier in the same month. The writer was Alan Moore, the penciler was Tony Salvador Daniel, and the inker was Kevin Conrad. The issue was dedicated to Leah Moore, Amber Moore, and all young urban monsters everywhere. Leah Moore would go on to co-author a number of miniseries with John Repien, who I think was her husband or her partner for a time. They both worked on the Albion miniseries that Wildstorm put out that was based on, I think, plots or ideas from Alan Moore exploring the British comic book characters that I think had fallen into the public domain. The children were born out of Alan Moore's relationship with a mutual lover named Deborah. The relationship between the three of them ended in the early 1990s, and his wife Phyllis and Deborah left with the children. That's the Alan Moore scene there.
Yeah.
Kind of got a little of that William Moulton Marston action going on.
The story begins with a couple up in the rooftop of a building just having a discussion about being vegetarian, and all of a sudden the girl that is putting up a sheet gets ripped to shreds. The kid gets ripped to shreds. Something's ripping through a hallway. A guy sees it, starts yelling at his wife to get his gun. He gets ripped to shreds. You see fingers. You see slashing toys. And the next we're introduced to Spawn's suit. Which, what was her name? The suit.
K7 Letha, daughter of the Seventh House of K.
Seventh House of K, yeah.
I liked it that the toy was obviously a Kermit.
Oh, yeah, that was a little twisted. I thought that was really interesting that the suit, we already knew it was a symbiotic relationship, but the suit comes from a house. Like, they're in high regard. That was kind of neat.
Well, and we see it hunting what looks to be something along the lines of a violator, like a not necessarily a Fleabag brother, but probably something of the same species, likely in the hellscape.
Yeah, probably a lower level demon, and it's hunting it. It's weird because it's in the shape of a Spawn, which I thought was kind of goofy, because how would it know it's on a humanoid? Because then Spawns come out in all different shapes and sizes.
I want to say, I do think that most of the Spawns we've seen have been humanoid. Okay. Typically male, too, for the most part at this point in time, but I don't know that it would have been safe to assume that it would look quite this human. So it might have been cool if it was a little bit more amorphous. And we see a bit more of that later on, too, where the Letha has its own way of moving about and representing itself. But a lot of what we know to be Spawn is apparently already there. All the chains and the skulls and the spikes and everything.
Yeah.
They talk about how those are her teeth, essentially, or those are some of her teeth, anyway.
Well, McFarlane probably couldn't do another symbiote. He couldn't have this liquid Spawn-looking shit slide everywhere without getting in trouble for that. So he's going to have to do something a little different. I always thought, like, you know, since, you know, you have, what, Stormwatch and all those, and you have all these aliens. Would any of those aliens go to hell before Malbolgia? And would he give them the offer to be a Hellspawn as well?
That's one of those things. McFarlane definitely was an island unto himself, which, for the most part, worked out well for him. Obviously, everything related to Chapel became a bit of a clusterfuck, and he had to keep it trying to explain that over and over again. It would have been nice to see more interaction with the Greater Image universe and elements like Wildstorm, but especially given what happens to Wildstorm, ultimately it was to the good that they didn't have a ton of that. But I think in the long term it hurt the Image universe, because especially after the first few years, less and less did it feel like a universe. It was always these little separate lines that only interacted under very special circumstances.
Yeah. So I remember when I was sitting reading, I was like, you know, there are aliens in the Image universe, and why do none of these show up before Malbolgia? You know, why doesn't he turn them into fucking Spawns? You don't see like a fucking, I don't know, some fucking Stormwatch creature in a Spawn suit bouncing around. So.
Well, yeah, anyway. I mean, and like, especially with Wildstorm, you literally have Cherubim and Daemonite. Yeah. So they're aliens that seem to be modeled after Judeo-Christian mythology. And also, you know, and I'm still curious about this, how the Lord Hellspawn possessed an Acheron from Youngblood, and that's why he has his distinctive look, why he doesn't look like a Daemonite, because it's actually the Acheron that you're seeing, not the Daemonite form.
Okay. We didn't see the homeless guys there, and they're waking up. Al was thrashing around. Apparently his chains were swinging around, and they were kind of worried about him. Then Twitch and Sam are up here. They're taking photos of where the people were basically murdered through an entire apartment complex, it looks like. And they're trying to figure out who it is. See, this is why I was kind of confused. Is this where Al starts thinking maybe his suit's doing it?
I don't think that he's made that association yet, because I'm not even sure that he's aware of the murders as of yet.
Oh, okay. He's sitting there and he's looking at his suit. I believe the suit does talk to him. Does it yet or not yet?
Because the suit is acting out beyond his consciousness and doing things that he doesn't want to do. In particular, they keep talking about how he's having blackouts and he doesn't like that. So this is where he's starting to think that maybe something happened when the suit was in Elysium, how it freaked out and did stuff that he didn't want to do and changed shape and stuff. And so he's thinking that there's still something residual wrong with the suit after that trip to heaven, essentially. He thinks that the problems with the suit are also causing him problems, but I don't think that they're directly interacting at this point in the story, and I think that he's still associating it more with the Angela miniseries rather than other events within Spawn's lore.
Because he's talking about his blackouts and his concentration, the skulls, well, I guess they could be warning markings, like the death head moth, only three-dimensional.
Or the chains, your appendages, what are you, what is my relationship to you, stuff like that.
Yeah, he's wondering what it feeds on, and he's worried that, is it hungry, is it looking for something to eat? And of course, then we're introduced, how do you say his name, the villain? Is it Snacker or Snakers?
I believe it's Sansker.
Sansker, okay.
John Sansker, which lets us know that this is the same guy from the Prelude story.
And so John Sansker is a monster hunter, and he's being introduced to the NYPD, that he's going to be there to help them.
John Sansker has a press conference, and at one point Sam's talking about how Twitch, this guy seriously undermines my masculine self-assurance. Look at him, he's a bronzed god. And Twitch is like, it's a cheap tan, sir, straight out of a bottle. Looks like the same brand I use. Like, I wouldn't have thought that Twitch would use a bronzer, but apparently that's the thing that he does. And I think that this isn't just some bullshit. I think they're intentionally referencing this bronzer for stuff that's going to happen later on in the book.
He starts bringing up about Spawn, but does he refer to Spawn as a vampire?
He doesn't like the V word, apparently. So he likes the term extra normal hazard and puts up beware posters all over town. Like, they were all about euphemisms at Image Comics in this time period. They never wanted to call anything a superhero or a vampire. So there's another instance of that, I would say.
Okay. And so Spawn is pissed off, you know, about these wanted posters all over the place. And he is somewhat concerned that maybe his suit is doing this stuff.
One thing I think is weird with the miniseries too is there's a lot of people that aren't in it. Like, we don't have any of the familiar reporters from Spawn Comics. Instead, we've got Gene Perry from the New York Times. And we don't have Bobby or any of the other homeless people that we're used to seeing. We've got these new guys.
Yeah.
They do make a point of mentioning that Sam and Twitch are having like their 9th anniversary as partners. So, and they're throughout the miniseries. But it's weird how there's like this little bit of an isolation. Like, there's this a whole new bunch of people specifically for this miniseries. So it's not to dip too much into what Todd's doing, I guess, in the main book.
We're now introduced to where the suit comes from. It's Hal.
The issue ends with another massacre in another tenement. And it's all being done through first-person perspective. I think that most probably Alan Moore was trying to reference Sam Raimi's work in the Evil Dead series, where you've just got the camera coming at people swiftly and doing all kinds of damage. In the Evil Dead movies, it's typically bashing through doors and knocking over trees and such, but going through car windows. And this one, it's going through people and just leaving this bloody trail all over the place. And you can't quite see what's doing it, but it's powerful enough to rip open an elevator, and it has no qualms about killing every motherfucker in the room. Doesn't matter. Men, women, children, none of that fucking matters. And we also keep getting flashes to the K7 Letha in its home with the twin sons casting dual shadows on the ground, and how the creature has these other sisters and they're building like thrones of skulls and all this kind of bullshit. So it definitely makes you wonder what kind of existence the symbiote has and whether or not it's doing these things to humanity, especially because after one of those flashbacks to Letha's time in her own realm, we find that Spawn is blinded by some headlights, surrounded by police, covered in blood near the tenement, appears to be the mass murderer. And that's how we end the first issue.
Yeah, he's covered in blood and stuff.
Number 2 came out July 20th, 1995, is dedicated to Linda Gebbe, the champ vamp. And Linda Gebbe, of course, is the one who did, I can't remember the name of the strip, but the saucy gal from the Tomorrow Stories. I can't remember what her name was. And she also did Lost Girls with him and a number of other projects. So Linda Gebbe is not only his longtime partner and the partner that ultimately replaced the threesome that he was in for a while there, but also has been a creative partner with him off and on throughout the years as well. The issue starts with footage from Newsnight Tonight, where they're basically recapping the massacres that had occurred in the earlier issues.
And at this point, Spawn is concerned that he is committing these murders because of his blackouts.
Spawn's trying to find the weapons that he had stashed way back in like issue 6 or so. And when he can't find them in his alley, he goes to find a weapons dealer that he knows in the area named Jacob Groenfeld. He's semi-retired. He was an old CIA contact. They were apparently buddies back when Al Simmons was alive. Of course, the weapons did end up in his hands. They used to sip rum in Costa Rica together. So Spawn thinks that he can trust this guy. Meanwhile, we go to scenes of Sansker in the television studio after he's done one of his briefings on the manhunt for Spawn. And curiously, this whole section is being done in the first person, not unlike what we saw from the killer's point of view, alludes to him being the killer pretty early on. They're in a lot of mystery to the mystery. Apparently, Sansker has a lead, so he hops onto a helicopter and goes to an apartment building east of the television studio to talk with a fellow he knows named Sonny. Meanwhile, Spawn is reminiscing with the arms dealer about their time in Costa Rica and the Philippines and how they had this great camaraderie.
Well, they had
all these jokes in the company days because he was the only black guy. They used to call him the snowman. And because the arms dealer was the oldest guy, they would call him Sonny. And that's how you know Sonny's the one who tipped off Sansker. Also, there's a bit about how Sansker is a Canadian guy and Spawn's like Canadian. Sonny, I've never told you that Sansker was Canadian. And they never told the audience that shit either. They just sort of dropped that shit.
No, I know. I was going to say. Well, then Sansker comes crashing through the window in a superhuman form. I guess you would say no.
Well, I mean, he's got a trench coat and his hair is flopping around. And there's a line where they talk about eyes like white hot marbles, swiveling, unblinking, Hugo Boss suit, ugly orange tan. Who is this guy? And the simple fact that he could jump out of a helicopter and fly through somebody's window lets you know that, you know, there's something to him. But also helps that he goes, good evening, little monster. I am death. And he even has a little like logo thing there. I don't know if they intended for that to be his superhero code name or not, but it's rather elaborate.
He and Spawn are fighting. Spawn gets tossed out the window. He goes right after Spawn. They're fighting. He's actually keeping pace with Spawn.
He's completely dominating Spawn. Well, and Spawn keeps repeating as he's falling out the window, he beat me.
Well, the suit kicks in afterwards and starts attacking him. It basically beats the shit out of him.
Now his nose is bleeding and he's knocked unconscious for a period of time, and then Spawn beats the fuck out of there.
And then he takes off. Now this is where I was confused in the book, because it goes from there to like, now he's on the pier talking to some homeless guy, talking about, get this suit off of me. I'm like, get that meat hook and hook it onto the suit. And he's running the opposite direction and he's like ripping the suit off his body. And they're going to throw the suit into like this fucking steam trunk. And then they're, you know, he's chaining it up and he throws it in the ocean. And he's talking about how like now he can feel the cold. And I guess he didn't realize how much that suit protected him.
And also he's like exhausted. He has no energy all of a sudden. So one wonders if he's driving some of his own sustenance. Since we never see him eat, he does drink some booze every now and again, but you don't really see him gathering his own energy. And they do mention how he's got the necroplasmic energy and shit, but you know, and I guess he's got the spawnometer letting him know that is a finite resource, but maybe there's some requirements to keep the physical form going beyond just the necroplasm. So it could be that the symbiote was actually helping to feed him as well as itself. But if the symbiote was running around massacring people to get that energy, Spawn wanted nothing to do with that. And that's why he has that big freak out. But again, it's weird that A, the homeless dude just happens to have a steamer trunk right by the pier, and B, who the fuck are these homeless people? Because we don't know any of these guys, and Spawn's being really familiar with a lot of them. In fact, he's bossing around and being kind of an asshole to them.
True. But they do turn on him as well, because they decide to, set him on fire?
And impale him with a stake.
And impale him. That's right. Because they thought he was a vampire because of all the wanted signs. And then, of course, at this time, the suit, I guess, is calling out to Al, whispering to him or talking about, you know, how they're, I don't know, they're like lovers or something like that.
Yeah, that's more in the third issue. Okay, basically, it talks about, you tossed me to the dark as if ours was some brief affair, but I am called K7 Letha. I am Raptor Queen of murder scarfs and strangle rags. I am she that entangles, and I am your bonded bride. I am a part of you. It is like love, save that it's real and lasts forever. Now, this is from issue number 3, August 24th, 1995, dedicated to Sylvia Moore, 1927 to 1995. This would be Alan Moore's mother, who worked as a printer.
They've staked him. He's run away on fire. He realizes he needs the suit. They are bonded together.
I don't know if he's quite there yet. I know he feels the call of Letha, but he's declining that because he's running around with stakes still buried into his chest. Cold river meat. I bob amongst the dead birds and the hypodermics. Daylight. How long was I out? Ahead, twin waste pipes poke out from the bank. A double-barreled shotgun full of crap aimed at the sea. I need a place to hide. Somewhere so wretched that nobody would have the stomach to come looking for me. A place where not even the lowest of vermin would go. And so he climbs into the tanks.
And that's where he runs into Violator. Violator laughs and says hi to him. Spawn is like, are you going to kill him? He's like, nah, I want you when you're healthy. I don't want to take you down when you're down. Yanks the stake out of his chest, leads him, tells him a little bit more about what his suit is. Because I guess he's more familiar with the different suits.
Because Spawn's concerned that the creature was a vampire and was drinking blood, and that maybe he or it got turned into a vampire when they were bit by the Wampir, when they were in the infernal dimension with Angela and all this kind of bullshit. Violator explains the suit doesn't feed off blood, it feeds off souls. And you can't be a vampire because you're already dead.
What is it? K6, K7, one of them pure breeds.
All this is a bunch of bullshit, and what it is they've been set up by the bad guy, Sansker, the clown's problem as well, because he knows that things are getting kind of hot in New York. He doesn't want to deal with it. So he puts on a suit and combs his hair, and at one point he says,
boy, will you look at me, kind of like Danny DeVito, only more distinguished, don't you think?
Essentially, the clown appears to be getting out of town cosplaying as Tony Twist. He makes mention of how...
Anyway, I'm off to Washington. No competition there except wussy youngbloods. Even you whipped one of them.
So I think, you know, we already did Violator Bad Rock, but I think this is actually where we see Violator going to Washington, which is where Bad Rock is going to capture him and go into the Violator Bad Rock miniseries.
Oh, okay. So that's where that series comes
in. Yeah, I think that's the setup. But unfortunately, I wasn't aware of that. And it's months later, so I fucked the continuity for the podcast. Unfortunately, but yeah, I think that's what happened.
Because in this one, I remember at the time, I don't remember reading the series when it first came out, but I do remember I was keeping up somewhat with Spawn, and I always thought it was weird when Twitch showed up and he's like in a cast, wasn't he? Or he's in a hospital.
Yeah, so, and I guess that's where this is happening too. One thing that they do show is very early on, Twitch especially, but even Sam, because Sam can sometimes be a little bit obtuse, they both don't buy into Spawn being the killer. Twitch in particular starts investigating Sansker. He notes the all-natural golden easy tan. He notes the inconsistencies, how somebody had been robbing blood banks, how nobody was actually getting their blood drained in these tenements. So why you keep talking about a vampire when nobody's actually getting their blood sucked? And he eventually breaks into Sansker's office, finds all these clippings from his monster hunting days that go back to 1704 and Captain Jean St. Clair, also called Jean Sanscour. And that's when he gets found by Sansker and assaulted.
Spawn is going after Sansker, and we find Twitch twisted up and stuffed into a mini fridge.
Sam had made his way to Sansker's office as well. He wasn't aware that Twitch was MIA, but he sees some blood dripping from a cabinet, and when he looks inside, he sees the twisted and bloody form of Twitch. Not yet dead, which I think is a bit strange. You'd think that he would either kill him or not kill him. You know, you wouldn't think there'd be this in between. You'd also figure that maybe if he was going to suck his blood, he would, but we see a little bit later on that that's not the case. But we're pretty clearly establishing that Sansker is a vampire and that he's been using the spray tan to cover up for that role. Also, Spawn is trying to make his way back to his suit because he recognizes now that he's going to need it. And he takes a car that some teenagers had hotwired previously and trying to make his way to the dock. Sansker catches up with him and trashes him again. Spawn goes into the drink, but Sansker has an issue with running water, so he doesn't want to be swamped. And he also makes a point about talking about how, tell them Heartless John sends his regards. And that's where he'd gotten that one Sanscours, whatever code name, because I guess that's French for no heart or some shit like that.
Yeah.
And then that leads us into the final issue that was released on September 21st, 1995, dedicated to Jake and Joseph Moore, the Men of Tomorrow, which unfortunately I haven't been able to find any reference to. So I don't know if those guys went off and did something else. I don't know if they're nephews or what they are.
Okay. And so in this one, I was sinking to the bottom. He's looking for the suit that's in the steam trunk at the bottom. He's being called. He's trying to reach his suit. He's realizing now how important the suit is to him. And Sanster is confronted by Sam. And that's where they kind of do the big reveal that, you know, he's a vampire. Tells him to hold. He has some police officers. Well, no, Sam wasn't 100% sure he was a vampire yet.
I don't know about I don't think he knew that he was a vampire. Or if he did, then he didn't take proper precautions. But he did know that it was clear that Sansker had assaulted Twitch. And then that's when Sansker just goes on this long-ass fucking monologue. This dude is just, like, expositing anything and everything that he can here at the end. He strips nude. He's got all these, like, tribal tattoos on him. Not a lot. Like, compared to what we see today on the streets of New York City, not that bad. But for the 90s, I guess he had a lot of tattoos. And basically talking about how he's been doing the whole monster hunting thing for years, but he only robs from blood banks. He doesn't drink blood from humans because of their sexual disease that had claimed a bunch of his fellows in the last decade, and just on and on and on. And then he just starts fucking killing all the fucking cops he can get his hands on, rather brutally. He kicks a guy's spine out and shit.
Yeah, he rips one's head out, puts his foot through another one. And the whole time, this is when Spawn is looking for the suit, finds the suit, and immediately the suit wraps around him. He's about to kill Sam. He's trashing the police car. He's already murdered any officers that's left. He has Sam, and just as about to do the killing strike, Spawn shows up and starts to battle him. Now, that was okay. So that's where I was a little confused in this one. So he's not your traditional vampire, correct?
He makes a point of talking about how he has magical abilities, but obviously he still avoids running water. He could probably get staked, tends to avoid sunlight, and he wears the spray on tan. At one point, Spawn says, the one thing too is apparently he's working so hard to like build up trust in New York so that he can basically take over and push all the other supernatural beings out of New York and have the city to himself. And he talks about how he's already run the Violator out and how this is just a dry run for Hong Kong, which is so promising. It's like, and I know Hong Kong's a badass city, but I don't think that you could level up to Hong Kong from New York, but whatever.
Yeah.
And then at one point Spawn's like, Sansker, listen to yourself. You sound like some kind of undead Donald Trump. You're a megalomaniac. And I think that the whole spray tan thing is probably a reference to that. So even back in the mid-90s, they had somebody's number.
Wait, did this come out before Blade or after Blade?
This is before Blade. So it's possible
So the whole vampires covering himself with sunscreen was probably taken from this?
Yeah, I don't remember that happening before this point.
I don't ever remember reading that. It's quite possible, but I don't ever remember reading a book where like they were smart enough to put like this super, you know, 5,000 SPS
bronzer
bronzer to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing it in that movie and thinking that was clever. And then reading this, I'm like, okay, well, it's been used. I was just kind of curious.
It had been 100 years since Dracula had died. The world of the White Ones has been without a leader ever since. Until now, until me. We don't get into vampire mafia like you do in the Blade movies, but there's clearly a hierarchy and, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the two, I would say. So it's possible there's an an influence there.
Now, Spawn does use his magic, and he talks about how he can finally smell and taste his magic, and that's when he starts warping, I guess, morphing into this creature. I mean, I'm not sure, is it like a vampiric creature, or...
I'm wondering, since they made a point of mentioning that he was Canadian, that maybe there's some elements of the Wendigo to him, but...
Oh, that's a good point. I think the
whole point of the tribal tattoos is they're supposed to be showing some sort of a Native American association, but the guy himself is clearly not that. So presumably he was some French colonizer who appropriated some Native American mysticism to make himself a super vampire, essentially.
Right, because he does talk about how he's been going through the centuries committing these crimes and going by different names. But the reason I bring it up is because, okay, so I have some of the old Spawn toys, and I do have this snake form monster, which I never knew what it came from.
What happens is that the Sanskrit gets exposed to the sunlight, the dawn finally rises, and Spawn thinks that he's got this guy dead to rights, and the guy even says, oh shit, without any euphemism or anything. There's no little symbols or anything. They actually let him curse in this one. And the guy is like,
you know, this is just such a cliche. This is almost camp, you know that? What do you think? That I'm going to turn to dust just like in the movies? I'm not Mel Lugosi. I'm Heartless John, and I'm a vampire's vampire. I gargle holy water and pick my teeth with crucifixes. In the Sudan, I once endured an hour of noon heat.
So basically saying that I'm one of the extra badass vampires, super duper powered, and eventually Spawn perceives it as his skin starts to melt, but actually what happens is he's fusing and he's turning into a more serpentine creature. He's all serpent tail, and he ends up diving into the sewers.
The whole time taunting Spawn. But like I said, I have several Spawn figures still in their packaging, and I always wondered, where did this character come from? Because it always felt sometimes like McFarlane was just creating shit just to throw it out there, just to fill toy orders at the time. And now I'm like, oh shit, it was from Blood Feud. Now I know where that fucking snake creature comes from.
Now, did this guy ever turn up again, though? He made a big deal about how he's going to take Hong Kong in 2070, and you know how he wasn't done yet, but I don't remember seeing this dude afterwards.
I have no idea. The snake creature escapes, goes into the tunnels, is laughing at Spawn the whole time, talking about, you know, this was what, like you said, a dry run, but that he's already fucked him in terms where the humans are scared of him. Everyone's scared of him now. Like, no one will trust him. They all think he's a murderer, so he's fucked his life. He has no friends, and he's relieving, and so Sam walks up and tells him they can fix this, and Spawn at this point, I guess, so this is canon, correct?
It's supposed to be, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we tied directly into Violet or Bad Rock, and then I think they're going to reference this going back into Spawn, and you know, the preview is in an issue of Spawn itself, so, and they talk a lot about how Tony Daniel is going to go from this series to do a run of issues on Spawn when it goes bi-weekly, so yeah, it seems like it's pretty tightly tied into everything.
I mean, Spawn just disappears. He jumps in the ocean and just like sinks to the bottom, or you know, where all the refuge is, because he feels like, you know, he has no one protect him but the suit. Like, the suit always loves him. The suit's always there for him. Not Wanda, not Terry and Cyan. There's a point where it was kind of like very emo, where he's just like, oh, the only thing that loves me is this suit. Which I guess kind of feels like the symbiote from Spider-Man.
At least Peter had Aunt May.
Ain't Mary Jane, but...
But yeah, he definitely goes full Robert Smith at the end. No reason to remain here in the world of day and light, when everything the sun reveals just shows me what I've lost. The dark is like a mother. Dark will soothe you. Dark will take away the pain. It's always night down here. The waterlogged mattresses don't know me. The lamprey flickering through the shadows doesn't give a goddamn. Welcome to the night. And I guess he's just gonna fucking stay down there and hang out with the fishies and shit. So I'm really curious to see when Spawn collides with this nonsense, the actual ebook.
Yeah, because like I said, I remember reading it and I was thinking, wait, does that show up in the rest of the fucking book? Like, that's really fucking weird.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little late when it came to Violet or Bad Rock, and maybe a little early when it came to Spawn, but because this is the issue that had the tie-in story, I felt like it'd be good to go ahead and get this knocked out. Plus, since we're talking about Spawn and his new costume, this is the miniseries that elaborates upon elements of the costume, so it seemed like a good time to do it, basically.
There's moments where it felt very Alan Moore, and there was moments where it felt very Paycheck. Like, it just didn't feel very deep. Like, I hate comparing all his work. Like, you know, I do on occasion like to go back and read V for Vendetta or The Watchmen, stuff like that, and that feels deep. And I get, you know, this is only a 4-issue. It just, I don't know. It seemed very rushed.
Yeah, why would you spend all these issues of build-up to the mystery, which is never really that much of a mystery because you only ever have one suspect that isn't Spawn, and they make it really clear early on that this guy is some bitch, especially if you read the Prelude story. So there's not an actual mystery, and then he just like fucking vomits out all those reams of exposition without making it super-duper clear. I mean, I guess he's trying to become the new king of the vampires and shit, but I don't know how conquering New York necessarily plays into that, and I don't know why it would be a good idea for him to run around with the bronzer, you know, and make a big spectacle of himself. He just seems like an asshole. Yeah, very much paycheck. I flash back to the interview that was conducted in Hero Illustrated that we covered on the Violet or Batrock episode, where he's saying that it's so hard for him and it's so taxing for him to do all the heavy duty deep stuff with all the research and shit. And so he needs something light, and he also points out that it's lucrative to do this shit. And I think there's an instance where McFarlane literally like gave him the basic plot, like, here, I want you to do a miniseries about this here. And so he did that. And it has its flowery flourishes, but it's still pretty crap for Alan Moore, and it has a rush job. And this is one where, peek behind the curtain, we basically have been months delayed in putting out the podcast, in part because you had bullshit going on, and then I had bullshit going on. And, you know, I was set on covering this particular miniseries. I'd already done the album art for it, and I even started reading it months ago, and it wasn't super engaging when I started on it. And then I kind of sped read it this afternoon. That's part of why I didn't take deep notes, but also because by the end of the second issue, I'm like, there isn't a lot here. And then once I got to last issue, like, I'm really glad I didn't take a bunch of fucking notes on this, because this isn't very good.
And I blew through it. I was a little disappointed. I'm just like, you're right, it was not very engaging.
And fucking the clown shows up out of, you know, I just happen to be in the same fucking toxic waste pipe that you're climbing into, which is why I'm going to put on a suit and comb my hair, because I'm not going to walk around smelling like toxic waste and make a point of saying he just smells like cheap cologne. It's like, you are in a toxic waste tube. And what does the clown do? He does more exposition. Instead of Spawn ever finding anything out or being a detective or some shit like you get in a Batman story, he just finds the guy who's going to tell him everything he needs to know. Because Spawn never does any of the fucking work in his own stories. He's just the bumblefuck who runs into the guy who actually knows what's going on. And this one underlies that shit.
So I don't know. I was very underwhelmed by this story.
Yeah, same here. So yeah, it was not worth the wait. Sorry, guys.
No. Yeah, sorry.
I found a book called Comics Debut. It only came out with 2 issues, and it was produced by Comic Shop News, who do the little folded pamphlet that you've seen in comic shops for the last 30 years or so. Yeah. And what they try to do is put out a comic book there's nothing but preview pages for upcoming books. And the first issue, cover dated June 1993, featured pages from Valeria vs. Spawn. And as we talked about previously, the book was eventually published as Nighthawk, but what's cool about this Comics Debut is they actually have pages where it was still Spawn on these pages. So it's like a couple of 3 pages that are fully colored, unlettered, and then a couple of pages that were still in the pencil stages. So if you check out our Tumblr, pretty much every episode of Spawnometer still has a Tumblr. I recommend checking that out so you can actually see a compare and contrast between the original pages and the pages with Nighthawk. So, and it's just cool to see Neil Adams draw Spawn.
Okay.
And speaking of the Tumblr, Batstick Blog liked the Trencher Mr. Monster Tumblr, and Superheroes Maybe Now reblogged episode 25's Tumblr for Image Zero. On WordPress, Seth Best liked our post Spawnometer 27, Trencher featuring Mr. Monster, and the Colorful Sisters liked the post Spawn 30 Tribe and followed us as well. As far as Twitter, we got attention from 20th Century Geek, Adriano, Alex Chung, Baby Skeletor, CH, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Citizen Kane Minute, Coffee and Comics, Comics 42, Days of High Adventure Podcast, who also thanked us for playing their promo on the last episode, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Ed Moore, Edward Hui, Fanholes Podcast, Green Lantern HG, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Joctastico, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Christados, Longbox Crusade, Luke Giaconetti, Earth Destruction Directive, Marvel Universe Online, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Nuka Carl Quantum, Podcasting's Michael Bailey, Schlockbus Inc., Siskoid, Sue Kent Ant, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Trekker Talk, Two True Freaks, You Should Be Listening, Under the Influence, Unpacking the Power of Power Pack, Warlord Worlds, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast.
Thank y'all. Hopefully we'll get back to the regular series and I can trash on that some more, but this was, and again, well, I'm a big Alan Moore fan.
That's another thing that hurts too, is because we're doing this podcast and because it's the lowest priced comic book in the industry, Spawn is still a $3 comic book. And a while back, Ken Lashley came onto the book, and I was thinking, you know, this is like like the first time that one of the biggest black superheroes in comic books is going to be drawn by an actual black artist, and one I quite like. And so I felt like an urge to go ahead and start reading Spawn again. Plus, Carlo Barberi took over the artwork, and even though I don't know that he's the best choice for a Spawn book, I think he did a good job on it, and I really like his artwork in general. So I decided to start buying Spawn, and therefore reading Spawn again. And we're talking about like post issue 300, right? So this is deep into the run, and I had to stop. It's just so fucking bad. We go back to the interview with Tony Daniel and Kevin Conrad earlier on. It's been 300 issues. McFarlane's written probably 200 of those. He's only gotten worse as a writer in the years since. The book still has no forward momentum, and now he's doing this whole thing where he's trying to launch a whole Spawn universe and try to do like the Spawn cinematic universe at some point, because he still wants to do the movie and shit. And it's like, it's still Gunslinger Spawn and She Spawn and fucking, like, there's no fucking ideas here. And all it was, the majority of the stuff that I read was Spawn's on an island with other versions of Spawn fighting yet another version of Spawn, and they're all falling in a hole. They all have to climb out of the hole. They're fighting amongst each other, and they get off the island and they have to go back to the island. It's like, it's just, it's horrible. It's bad. Wow. It's so hard to read this shit. And I know it got a big sales bump with issue 300, and it's now the longest running independent comic book of all time. But everything that you ever thought was wrong with Spawn is as bad or worse 320 issues later, whatever it's at. It's just so bad. And it's like, knowing that Todd's just going to get worse as he progresses and become even more anti-writer, since he hasn't had a scripter on the book in a long time. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is still the spine of our podcast, and we're still going to be covering Spawn stuff, but it's really hard to get excited about Spawn specifically as a book, having read it and seen that it's still just an absolute fucking shit show, and it's multiplying, and he's going to have more shitty books besides. It just takes there's so much potential in the Spawn concept. You could turn this over to some writers and do some really cool shit. And I do think there's a new book called King Spawn, and I think that some of the guys involved with Killadelphia are doing that, so at least he's got some co-writers, and he's brought in some other artists, which is nice. Some name brand guys. He's obviously spending a little bit of money on this shit. I wish he would at least get a scripter for his own book so that it would read better and not be so grammatically questionable. And I think there's still some misspellings in the book itself, and the dialogue just sucks, and it's fucking awful. Todd, quit fucking writing. Not any fucking good at it. If you gotta get, again, that's what happened here apparently, is Todd said, hey, Alan Moore, I would like you to do this over here, and Alan Moore did that shit. As bad as this miniseries is, this is like deep mediocre, especially for Alan Moore. It's like flatline Alan Moore.
Yeah.
But it's not terrible. It's readable. It's just not that good. Whereas reading Todd McFarlane writing is like painful. It hurts. It's not flat. It's like dipping down low. It's just bad. So I don't want to read any more Todd McFarlane shit. And, you know, so that a lot of the promise of Spawn, recognizing that 300 issues later, it's still going to be an absolute shit show. It's just, it definitely hurts the momentum some. But also, it's just, we couldn't get on the same page, and Spawnometer takes a little bit more in terms of research and reading and shit. And we just couldn't get it together to get that done, in part because it fucking sucks.
Damn.
Sorry. So yeah, anything to elaborate on with this one?
No, sir.
Then we're done.
Yeah.
Welcome, one and all, to the Fire and Water Racetrack and Arena. Please direct your attention to the center of the track, where you will see 36 buses lined up between two ramps, a tank full of live man-eating sharks, and a high wire stretching over it all. The rocket cycle is warmed up and all the nets have been removed. Who would attempt these stunts just to entertain and inspire his audience? What kind of man? What kind of hero? There, coming in on a rocket-powered skateboard, it's the death-defying human fly cast! Join me, Max Romero, and a rotating roster of guests as we dive headfirst into the colorful comics of Marvel's The Human Fly. The death-defying Human Fly cast is a limited episode podcast spotlighting the adventures of a man who comes back from a crippling auto accident to become a mysteriously masked stuntman with a mission to inspire others to never give up hope. We'll also talk about the real-life Human Fly, a daredevil with a murky past and a desire to be the best stuntman in history, until the day he just disappeared. The actual Human Fly would vanish as suddenly as he had materialized, but not before sparking a comic series featuring what would be the wildest superhero ever. Because he was real! The death-defying Human Fly cast, coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast Network. It's gonna be wild.
In 1974, four men literally changed the face of rock and roll forever.
Gene Simmons, Peter Criss, Ace Frehley, and Paul Stanley wanted to become the band they never got to see.
Over the next 40 plus years, the music, the makeup, the merchandise, and the loyal fan base have propelled Kiss to one of rock and roll's elite groups.
With Kiss heading down their end of the road tour, we thought we would start our journey.
Turn it up to 10 because we love it loud.
Right Between the Eyes is a podcast all about our favorite band, Kiss.
We will be covering all eras of Kiss with the various albums, studio, live, and compilations, plus album mashups and more.
We will also cover solo and band projects from all members, past and present, while also looking at the various bands that have opened for Kiss as well.
Not to mention all of the fun items in the Kiss catalog. TV appearances, long-form videos, merchandise, comic books. Come on, the list goes on and on.
Coming in late May, early June 2021 to a podcast platform near you.
Follow us on Twitter at RBTE Podcast.
Loud.
I want to hear it loud.
Right between the eyes. I want to hear it loud.
Greetings, guys and ghouls. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and this is The Monsters That Made Us. Join Monster Mike Manzi and I on the last Friday of every month as we celebrate all of the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. From The Phantom of the Opera to The Creature Walks Among Us, we sink our teeth into all the gory details as we dissect the films that gave us some of the most iconic movie monsters of all time. The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more information, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!